This episode is brought to you by Thorn, the industry leader in nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is actually trusted by 8 US national teams and championship teams in the NFL, NBA, and Major League, as well as recently becoming the official sports performance nutrition partner of the UFC. So when it comes to supplements, the tactical athlete space and the athletic space need two things. We need efficacy, meaning the products do what they say they're going to do on the label, and then we need to trust the fact that we are not going to fail either athletic drug tests or work-related drug tests. Now, Thorn has actually been around since the 1980s, where they were used by physicians and hospitals for nutritional supplements for the patients. They were so successful that athletic teams and even special operations teams reached out to them and they started supplying them as well. Very recently, they actually opened their doors to the general public. Now, what sets Thorn apart is they manufacture their own products in a state-of-the-art NSF-certified facility in South Carolina. They use only the purest possible ingredients, formulated with no stearates or arbitrary fillers, in the cleanest manufacturing process. Most of you listening come from a profession where it can take its toll physically and mentally, and many of us are not able to bolster our nutrition purely with the food that we eat. And that's where supplementation comes in. So if you're ready to maximize your health and performance, visit thorn.com, thorne.com. Take a short product quiz to be paired up with the perfect health and fitness supplements. And for you, the audience, if you use the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, BTS10, you will get 10% off your first order. And if you want to learn even more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of Behind the Shield podcast, and you will hear my interview with Wes Barnett and Joel Totoro from Thorn. Welcome to episode 336 of Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week I'm extremely excited to welcome back onto the podcast Joel Salatin. Now, Joel is a world-renowned holistic farmer who has appeared on multiple documentaries, including Forks Over Knives and Food Inc., and was also my guest on episode 4. So if you haven't heard that, I highly recommend listening to that. But in the wake of this pandemic, I really want to pull out some of the basal health practices that we can glean from clean farming, from understanding what we're eating and the quality of what we're eating, so that we can then build resilience within the communities around the world. So this was another amazing interview with Joel. I'm so, so glad he was able to come back on. Before we get to that interview, as I say every single week, please just take a moment, go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback. I really do love reading the feedback, and then leave a rating. The 5-star ratings truly do make us more and more visible for people looking for a project like this. And then this is a free library for you, the audience, whether it's individually, whether it's in a fire department, a police department, a business, use these incredible episodes for your own growth. And all I ask in return is that you help share these amazing men and women stories so that we can get them to every single person on planet Earth that needs to hear them. I truly, truly believe that there are some life-changing stories on here. So with that being said, I introduce to you Joel Salatin. Enjoy. Joel, firstly, I want to say thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. You were one of my very first guests, episode 4, which was almost 4 years ago now. So here we are, sitting in the middle of a pandemic. So welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's a delight and an honor to be with you, James.
Brilliant. Well, I would love to jump straight into that topic. I heard you on Joe Rogan a few weeks ago, and the things you talked about resonated deeply with me, and there's some other things I'd love to expand on that you guys didn't have time to address. Right off the bat, so tell me, from your perspective as a holistic farmer, what have been your observations with the last few months?
Well, the main observation is that we, as a culture, we have refused to take personal responsibility for A, getting healthy, and B, the level of sickness that we've had in our country. I mean, you know, every country wants to, you know, have the best gymnast or the fastest 100-yard dash runner. You know, there are places where you want to lead the world, but there are places where you don't want to lead the world. And the fact that the U.S. leads the world in non-infectious morbidity, so that's, you know, cancer, diabetes, obesity, things like that that take life, heart disease. The fact that we lead the world, we're number one in the world in those per capita, you know, should give us pause. For all our cleverness, we're not in a good place. And I would suggest that perhaps that's one reason why we're suffering more than other countries. It's not because of, you know, face masks and lockdowns and you know, other things. It's to me, it's consistent with the fact that we lead the world in these non-infectious, what we call, you know, Western lifestyle problems. And so, you know, I would love to see somebody push Anthony Fauci aside one time and take the microphone and say, okay, America, let's spend 1 week working on our immune system. We can do that a lot faster than a vaccine, and we can do that right now, and it doesn't really cost us anything. So what would be a recipe for, you know, immune building? So first of all, for a week, you know, we're not going to drink any Coke, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, you know, sugary drinks. We're not going to eat junk food. We're not going to go to McDonald's. You know, we're going to actually, you know, cook and eat unprocessed foods. And we're going to sleep 8.5 hours, and we're going to drink 3 quarts of water to get rehydrated. Almost every American is dehydrated, which is a real health issue. And we're going to spend 1 hour a day outside. I mean, we're in the summer. There's never a better time to spend an hour a day outside, getting some vitamin D, some exercise, you know, throw ball with the dog, the kids, the whatever. Grandma, I don't care, but get out and get some activity, some exercise, throw the ball, and then maybe it would be good to forgive everybody that you hate. because hatred and vengeance drop cortisol levels and play havoc with our immune system. So let's live and let live and get rid of that. And you know, I mean, those are like 6 things I just mentioned. But I mean, if we really devoted ourselves to that for 1 week, you know, and another one might be instead turn off the depressing news for at least 1 hour a day and watch something hilarious like Red Skelton or Laurel and Hardy or, you know, and just laugh strong and hard for an hour a day. You know, that might be good too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I've seen from the beginning. I want to explore, obviously, the whole building immunity side in depth in a minute. But for what we've got now, for where people are, you know, in their health when this first started, to me, 2 things. Firstly, as a firefighter paramedic for 14 years, when they started touting the numbers and showing images from ERs, you know, I'm like, well, that's what happens every day in America. In the inner city, our ERs are swamped usually, you know, so there's a lot of false narrative. But the only way that you're going to build resilience is, like you said, you know, in the very short term, aside from the nutritional and exercise element, is the state of mind. And it was the complete opposite, where they basically scared the shit out of everyone, thus, you know, further lowering the immunity of the population.
Yes. And the whole fixation, I guess the right word is fixation. When you are fixated on fear, yes, you don't function. Your body, your whole physical, you know, system, when you're fixated on fear, your body doesn't function very well. So when we quarantine, I mean, never in history have healthy people been quarantined. Here we are, you know, normally you quarantine sick people or, you know, that's how you stop these things. So instead of quarantining sick people, you know, we're quarantining healthy people and upsetting everyone's life, disappointing people, creating incredible economic hardship on many people, and all of this adds to this fear fixation, this paranoid hysteria fixation that becomes an all-consuming thing in our psyche, and then of course it permeates then into our physical health, and it's very unfortunate. I mean, it's good to be aware of things, but to be completely fixated on fear is not a healthy cultural position to be in.
No, and it seems like from what I'm seeing, we're being sold almost the idea that there should be no death or disease at all. So that's like the baseline for them versus, you know, the death or disease that we see. And if there was a ticker tape in the corner, you know, a number counting the narrowing of arteries, that thing would blow, you know, the COVID numbers out the war. And that's what's so disappointing is I've never seen anyone do a mandatory non-evacuation where you can't go home. You have to stay outside and run and play and exercise and pick fruit and eat it. And, you know, we lose millions and millions and millions of people to obesity. We lose millions to cancer from cigarettes. And I don't see the same push for any of these conditions that are killing, you know, numerous times more people than COVID.
Yes. Well, yesterday our Virginia news here, the top story was Virginia. You know, we lost two people died yesterday from COVID in Virginia, and this was the top statewide news story. Two people died. Well, how many people died of a heart attack or suicide or goodness, a car wreck? You know, to make that headline news, it's just hysteria. Yeah, I agree with you 100% that there are. Is this a thing? Yes, it is a thing, but it is certainly, it doesn't deserve the level of fear that it's created. Like you say, you know, narrowing of arteries, you know, the different things. Different diseases and things, you know, we're still far behind many things, and the refusal of the data points to indicate who is getting this. I mean, it is so primarily toward people with comorbidities, but the data points just have to give, you know, report the numbers, because if you say that, you know, if you point out that, you know, 80% of the people are over 80 years old, then suddenly you're expressing ageism and that sort of thing. And so, you know, isn't it amazing that out of this whole period of fear, quarantining, economic and emotional stress, here we come in with the George Floyd thing, we come in with the urban violence thing, and the looting and the racism, and, you know, cities are burning, and we have pent up. I'm convinced that much of this violence we're seeing in our cities right now is partly just pent up. It's pent up expression of 4 months of being couch potatoes, and, you know, we're not built to be hermit couch potatoes.
No, I mean, I think it's an interesting perspective, even for the way we do prisons in a lot of the Western world. You know, locking people away for hours and hours and hours. This has been a great social experiment that is not good for rehabilitation, because it's turned some very seemingly normal people into, you know, some pretty crazy behaviors that you see on the news. But what I want to get to is the preventative side, because that's not what's being spoken about. And then I want to also get to the, you know, the creation of some of these diseases through, you know, market and farming practices. But when this first kicked off, I made a video about how I was worried about first responders, because the shifts that they work, the long, long work weeks, they are, you know, the ones that people are leaning on. They're probably some of the less resilient people. And we've seen many, many police officers and firefighters die. I've got two friends that were both in ICU. Thankfully, they're both out now, but they had multiple things, multiple areas that would have compromised their immune system, which is why they had such a severe reaction. So what are we doing wrong as a nation that's creating one of the wealthiest countries on the planet, an ill health epidemic?
Well, I think this has to go clear back to the soil, that we, as a culture, I mean, we developed genetically modified organisms. We developed DDT, glyphosate. Goodness, we developed a food pyramid in 1979, the USDA did, that put, you know, Cheerios and Fruit Loops on the, as the foundational, you know, on the foundational level of the food pyramid. As a nation, we were the first in the world to say it was wrong to eat lard and butter, and told everybody to go to hydrogenated vegetable oil. Remember all the margarine ads. And so my point there is that we have led the world in experimenting to the fringes of fake and adulterated fertilizer, soil development, plant development, and foods. Other cultures, I mean, you don't have to travel very much, but if you travel around the world, you will find that cultures really define themselves with a food culture, an architecture culture, a religion culture. I mean, Prince Charles says that every culture is defined by three things: food, architecture, and religion. And when I go around the world and ask somebody in Germany or Sweden or you know, Spain, and say, when I say America food culture, what do you think of? I've never found anybody that said anything except McDonald's. And that represents the, you know, the most, you know, a factory farmed industrial chemical oriented food that leads the world in numbers, in number of people who eat that kind of food as a percentage of per capita consumption. And number two, it came here first. And now, of course, we're trying to export this. We're exporting Coca-Cola, exporting McDonald's, you know, all over the world. And every culture, every country where these are exported, guess what? We see diabetes, we see obesity, and we see heart disease. You know, we see these things developing. So, you know, it's not rocket science to appreciate that in our luxury and in our convenience-oriented and I would just say non-cultural food tradition. I mean, they're fascinating thread of thought that. That in, for example, in Europe, the phrase is not, well, did you get enough to eat? It is rather, well, how did it taste? And in Europe, actually, there's a culture of eating not very much at a meal, because it was in royalty. When you have royalty and peasants, you have a very, you know, demarcated culture. It was a sign of refinement and wealth that I didn't have to gorge on food because I knew there was another meal coming. In America, as we started, and I'm going back here, but you know, listen, cultural DNA goes deep. And in America, where we came to this frontier, and you didn't know if you were going to get a next meal, and so we developed a food culture of getting enough. Did we get enough to survive? Read the Lewis and Clark expedition. I mean, these guys literally went, you know, day to day, wondering if they were going to get something to eat. There were no big fat Dunkin' Donuts guys on the Lewis and Clark expedition. They were lean and mean, and they literally went from musket shot to musket shot with deer or bear or whatever they could get. And so our American food tradition was very, very different. We developed a very, very different tradition. It was not about quality. It was not about texture or taste or terroir, like in France. There was nothing like that. It was just, did you get enough to go another day? And this was even a Native American thing. I mean, one of the reasons the Native Americans were so prone to alcohol problems was because they ate sporadically. When the bison were around and they could get enough to eat, they would eat up to 10 pounds of bison in a day and just sit around and gorge for a week, because it might be, a couple of weeks till they got another really good meal. And so this was also a Native American thing as well. And so, the Europeans, as they came here and interacted with the Native Americans and saw the lack of security, our deep DNA in our area is a food of, did you get enough? Did you fill up of food feasting, or I should even say indulgence and overeating, as opposed to the more European concept. And so that's deep in our DNA. And so as we have come in our modern culture to where we were able to grow plenty and we were able to grow it cheaply, we didn't have a food tradition, if you will, a quality type food tradition like in Europe. We developed a more kind of food is a necessity. It's a sideline, but the real work is building railroads and doing important work, and food's kind of a sideline to the really important stuff in life, and that's kind of our culture. And so the result is that we don't put attention on food like other cultures do.
Now, you mentioned about the railroads and everything. So the one thing that I see over and over again, you can talk about the industrialization of food, the mega farms, and even things like racism, starting with slavery, is the common denominator is a few people wanting to get incredibly wealthy at the expense of the masses. So what seeing as we're on this kind of history timeline, kind of walk us through how we went from more local farms to the industrialization, and then what impact that had back in the the middle of last century.
Sure. So, I think all of us can bear blame. I mean, I'm not a victim kind of person. I can repent. I've got plenty enough stuff to repent about as well as anybody else. And so, I think a simplistic answer to that is not helpful. We need to understand that all of us as a culture, we were complicit in this move from craft and artisan work and small farms to these industrial mega farms, monocropping, mono things. And again, part of this was due to food security and government thinking, well, we can move this along, we can incentivize so that we're never short of food at all. And so we, early in the 20th century, we started the food programs, we started subsidies. Of course, Abraham Lincoln started the USDA, which I'm sure he thought would be helpful, but it turned out that the fraternity between the government and the industry was a bit of an unholy alliance and has created amalgamation, centralization. And of course, everything was about efficiency. Can we be efficient? And so as our country industrialized, we saw food as an industrial thing as well. And America, more than any other culture, I think, bought into this idea that life is mechanical, kind of a mechanical view toward life. And rather than life being biological. And, you know, are there some, you know, mechanical elements? Well, yeah, you know, you've got leverage in your limbs and joints and things like that. There are certainly mechanical elements. But the idea of biology, where it can heal, where it can be wounded and heal, that's very non-mechanical. You know, if your front wheel bearing goes out and starts to thump, you don't stop the truck and wait for it to heal or go around and ask for it to forgive you for not lubricating it. Nothing repairs it except replacing the bearing. But fortunately, living things, including our own psychology, we can say an unkind word to somebody and then apologize, and that wound can heal. And physically, it can heal. We get a scrape, we get a splinter, we get a cut, and it can heal. That's very different biologically than mechanically. But we develop these chemical fertilizers, the pesticides, the herbicides. Of course, World War II, we had these stockpiles of anhydrous ammonia, and frankly, farmers were tired of shoveling poop. Very tired of shoveling poop. We'd shoveled and shoveled and shoveled and shoveled and shoveled. And, boy, if you present a farmer, you want to shovel poop all day, or would you rather just put on this little bag of 5-10-10 and be done with it? Almost any farmer's going to grab that bag of 5-10-10. So be gentle on great grandpa, you know, in post-World War II when he reached for that bag of chemical fertilizer when he was worn out and tired of shoveling and shoveling. Well, what happened was, that through the 1950s and early 1960s, as mechanization and equipment developed on farms, the other side was not standing still either. The infrastructure necessary to run a carbon-based, organic matter-based farm fertility program was also developing. I mean, we're talking about water pipe, front-end loaders, PTO shafts, ground-driven manure spreaders, chippers and shredders and that sort of thing. And so, you know, the infrastructure to run a credible, viable, alternative, carbon-based, non-chemical approach was well in place by the mid-60s and late 60s. But by that time, the chemical approach had completely come to dominate our universities, our government institutions, and even the food system. So, you know, you have that threat on the farm. Meanwhile, you have post-World War II tax policy. Taxes are going up, and so we have two income earners instead of one income earner. Took the woman out of the house. I'm being very sexist, but this is fact. This is the way it was. Took the women out of the house. Well, now they can't cook anymore. So now we got to have TV dinners. Those came in the late 50s. You also had the notion in the 50s that breastfeeding babies was somehow Neanderthal and barbaric. And if you wanted to really be, you know, hip and modern, you used Enfamil and Similac, and we raised a generation of asthmatics on artificial milk. Now we know, of course, that breast milk is absolutely the best. We have, you know, that whole orthodox narrative has inverted back to, you know, ancient heritage wisdom of not only is it healthy for the baby, but in post-life we know that there's a directly between breast cancer and breastfeeding, and if breastfeeding has occurred, there's a lot less breast cancer later on in life. All those things develop. So our pendulum really, really swung into this industrial paradigm of life, this kind of artificial, sterile, mechanical life view. And as a result, the only measure is pounds and efficiency. And when you just measure in pounds and efficiency, without regard to quality, without regard to destruction of something on the way to that, like, you know, every bushel of soil loses two bushels of, I mean, every bushel of corn loses two bushels of soil, a dead zone the size of Rhode Island in the Gulf of Mexico, those externalized costs on the way to efficiency today, we basically sold the future for today's prosperity. And the result of that has been a new lexicon that's developed in our culture. I mean, those of us over 60 years old, as children, we never heard terms like food allergy. You know, if you wanted a potluck or a birthday party, moms didn't have to call each other and say, you know, what kind of food allergies am I dealing with? You just got together and shared food, you know. E. coli, salmonella, campylobacter, listeria, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, high path avian influenza. I mean, this is all a lexicon, food allergy, all a lexicon that's developed as a result of cheating and taking shortcuts with our ecological womb, our ecological umbilical. And more of us now are realizing, oh, well, I guess resiliency is as important as efficiency. And we need to think about how we actually have a regenerative food system that regenerates the soil, regenerates the commons, air, water, and regenerates the human strength. How do we have a food and farming system that is fundamentally biological and regenerative, as opposed to just mechanical, exploitive, and efficient? And those are the conversations now that this whole, that our disruptive point in history, those are the conversations we're starting to have. And it's a very, it's about time, and it's a very positive thing. It's the silver lining of the cloud of the uncertain, insecure times we're dealing in, to be pushed to start having some of these conversations.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you highlighted the ownership of each one of us as well, because, you know, when you look at that path, you realize that we created it. You know, the reason why that mega supermarket made it in your town and shut down the butcher and the baker and, you know, everyone else was because we went there. But I think what is very empowering is if we take that lesson and, you know, get over the shame, if we can realize that the absolute opposite is also in effect. So if we choose to now we understand it, to go seek out our local farmers, you know, support the brand new butcher or, you know, craft brewer or coffee shop, whatever it is, then we are going to turn that around ourselves. And that's what I've learned. And I grew up in England and then, you know, moved here about almost 20 years ago now. Whether it's a prime minister in the UK or a president here, none of those people are going to fix your problems for you. We as the nation have to band together, and we can vote. And I don't think that the actual ballot slip does too much, to be honest, but I think the dollar or the pound does an incredible amount. So by us searching the right places, the small farms, you know, all the areas that actually are healthy, we can reverse it, but we have to do it together.
Yes. Whatever physical manifestation we have right now, you know, whether it's eroding soil or nutrient deficient food or full hospitals or whatever it is simply a cumulative physical manifestation of trillions and trillions of decisions that we have made, you know, over the course of history. We have arrived where we are because we've been traveling that direction. And if we want to arrive at a different point, we need to travel a different direction. And so, yes, you're exactly right. Tomorrow's context, you know, let's just go out 50 years to maybe our, you know, our grandchildren when they're our age, when their context will also be a physical manifestation of the trillions and trillions of decisions that will be made between now and then. And you know, that sounds simplistic, but it's absolutely true. And so as we start making different decisions, we're going to change that trajectory. You know, on our little farm, cooler bags, we have our logo on one side, and on the other side is a moniker that says "Healing the Land, One Bite at a Time." And we put that on there so that all of our customers understand that when you buy soil building, water replenishing, air refreshing, nutrient dense food, you are creating a fundamentally healing context as opposed to a sickening context. And that's a legacy worth investing in, and it's a legacy worth leaving.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important point that a lot of people misunderstand, is that America is overfed, but we're malnourished. And I think that the lack of education of the impact of destroying our soil having on the actual nutrients of the food that we put in our mouths is a lesson that needs to be taught. So how do we reverse the damage that we've done to our agricultural land? And, you know, how can we regenerate it to the point where we can, you know, create incredibly nutritious foods again?
Yeah, well, there are kind of two threads of thought on that question. I mean, one thread is, well, we need better ag policy, a better farm bill. We need to quit, subsidizing and protecting, corn, soybeans, cotton, sugar, and rice and wheat, the six commodity crops that all require tillage and use by far and away the largest share of chemicals and pesticides on the planet. There's that element, just a change of policy. But that's the bogeyman out there. That's the easy way to point your finger and say, okay, so I'm not responsible. Somebody else has to fix this. That's always the temptation, isn't it? You know, that I can't do anything about this. I can't change policy, so I go on my merry way. Which brings me to the second thread, and the second thread is, what can we do personally? So, frankly, I'm not real optimistic about whatever governmental direction, federal change of orthodoxy. I mean, you see stuff change once in a while, but in general, the trajectory seems to be not toward a good place. And so that brings me back to the thread of personal responsibility. What can I do? And I kind of have three areas that a person can participate in today. And one is you can get in your kitchen, and that's not a sexist thing, but in our kitchens. I mean, we have never had so many techno-glitzy, gadgetized, convenience infrastructure in our kitchens, but we've never been so lost as to how to use them, where they are. The average American spends less than 14 minutes a day in their kitchen, and I heard a food talk lately, actually a professor from Oxford in England. And he's a food marketing guru, and he said in my generation we always asked what's for dinner, and today's young people ask what's dinner, and that was a really profound phrase. I thought it was great because it's true. You know, we buy little single serving packages, and so kind of my new litmus test for people that are thinking about this is, are you eating leftovers? You know, because leftovers show that you actually probably cooked something from scratch. You ate as a family, and you're not going out to eat tomorrow. You're, for lunch, you're going to have leftovers. I mean, I've lived on leftovers all my life. I love them, you know. I mean, there's nothing more convenient than eating leftovers. And so get in your kitchen. That's number one. Number two is do something yourself. I mean, you can get a vermicomposting, a little earthworm bed under your kitchen sink to eat your food scraps. You can grow a tomato on the patio, on the front porch, a little herb. You know, now there's all these cool little, urban gardening, gadgets, you know, from like PVC pipes with pockets in them that you can hang on your front porch, window boxes to, you know, postage stamp backyard, kinds of things, you know, barrel gardens, all sorts of things. So, you know, you can grow something yourself, and just participate in the majesty, the mystery, and the awesomeness of life. It'll teach you to be humble and realize that, you know, I'm not the center of the universe. There's something bigger going on here than just me. And the third thing, then, so we got get in your kitchen. Number two, grow something yourself, anything. And number three, then, is to take a portion, budget your recreational entertainment time, and build some relationships with your local food shed. Every area now has really great, authentic, integrity farms that are, fertilizing with compost instead of chemicals. They are, producing a diversified product as opposed to monocrops. And they're, most of them are direct marketing, or they have some sort of a local brand identity. Meet some of these people. Go visit their farms. And let me tell you, right now during this whole coronavirus thing, there's not a better place to go that's safer and more entertaining than a farm. I mean, this isn't Disney World. It's not, you know, it's not a theme park. It's not even a museum. You know, it's just out here in the country. Wiggle your fingers through some soil. Walk barefoot through the pasture, you know, and start creating some relationships and connections with your local farmer food shed, so that you will have that level of connection and food security, so you're not the one that's stuck in the future. The one that's stuck is the one that goes to the supermarket and says, "Ooh, the shelves are empty, but I know where my food is. It's right here at, you know, Farmer John's or Farmer Jill's or whatever." And if you develop that, you know, your farmers will take care of you also, and during good times and bad, whatever. So those are three things that anybody could do to invest in a different trajectory than the way we've been going.
Well, I love that. You hit on a very, very important point as well, and something I just kind of had an epiphany on recently. When you said leftovers, so in the fitness space, there has been this big kind of upsurgence of what they call meal prepping. And you basically, you know, prepare meals for several days and you can either freeze them or whatever. But basically, that's what we call leftovers for hundreds and hundreds of years. Because I mean, I grew up on a farm and it was the same thing. They'd cook for double the size of the family. And that way, the next day you had, you know, it doesn't have to be the next day even. A day or two later, you ate what you ate prior, and is no more convenient than leftovers. I mean, even McDonald's, you still got to go there and sit in a car in a drive-through or wait in a line, whereas you just open your fridge and the meal that you cooked a couple of days ago is now there just to be heated up again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And again, when I say get in the kitchen, you know, I'm not talking about grandma's kitchen where, you know, she had to get up at 4 o'clock to put wood in the stove to get it hot enough to fry eggs on when Papa came in from milking the cow. We now have time bake, and we've got bread makers, ice cream makers, hot and cold running water, and refrigerators and freezers and microwaves and all the gadgetry that you can imagine. So it's never the thing is, it's never been easier. It's never been more convenient to be in our kitchens. And so let's utilize the technology that we have. Never has it been easier to to eat more responsibly than now, and so we need to exercise that.
Absolutely. Well, another area that I really want to get your perspective on is, do you know who Jamie Oliver is, a British cook?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
So Jamie did an incredible thing in the UK. I think he tried to do it here in the US as well, where he changed the what school food looked like in British schools and tried over here in the US. And to me, that is absolutely where the first line needs to be. If we're educating our children on what food is, how it's grown, and then serving that same clean food in their cafeterias, you're going to create an entire generation of kids that, you know, aren't programmed by fast food and processed food anymore. But one of the pushbacks I always hear from people, and I think it comes from, you know, lack of education, is, oh, that'd be more expensive. And Jamie appeared to show that that was absolutely false in the documentaries that he was shown in doing that in the schools that he worked with. So from your perspective, can we feed our children in the schools for the same budget that they're given for the whatever it is, Cisco food that's shipped in?
From my perspective, no. We are going to have to invest more in food, and I'd love to see some of his budgeting. I know there are major cost savings. For example, if the school actually cooks food instead of getting all pre-processed, there can be some pretty significant savings. Also, I know that nutrient-dense food satiates faster, so you don't need to eat the volume that you do when you're just eating empty calories, or calories that aren't hooked up with the more with depth nutrition. And so, you know, there are some, so I'm sure some of this is all part of that. Of course, you know, there's always the externalized costs of higher quality food, cheap food, externalized costs from, you know, dead zones in riparian areas, to the fact that, you know, half of all cases of diarrhea are from foodborne illness. And we just have all of the diseases of nutrient deficiency as well. And I don't think we've begun to explore all of those externalized costs. But, good food goes fast, goes farther. I mean, I was telling a guy yesterday, recounting a story that we got from a chef that we started taking eggs to, and our eggs were like, you know, three times as expensive as the Cisco eggs he'd been using. But he said, we actually make more money with yours because in the regular industrial eggs, there's always a couple cracked or broken in the flat because the shells are thin. Well, those have leaked over onto their partners, and you end up sticking your finger through a couple of those trying to get them dislodged from the glue of the white that's leaked out into its neighbor, you know, egg. And then if somebody wants an over easy or sunny side up fried egg, then next thing you know, the yolk breaks because you don't have a structural integrity in the egg. You have to throw that one away, get another one. So he said, even though we're paying more for yours, they actually go a lot farther because we never have to throw one away. There's never a broken one, and of course. It's not just a broken egg or the throwaway. Then you have the labor, you have the cooking time. All of those kinds of things add up. We know, for example, that all of our meats cook 20-30% faster than industrial meat. And we believe that it's because industrial meat is all full of adrenaline. Adrenaline tightens up muscle tissue. And these factory animals, they're stressed their entire life. And so all that cumulative stress comes out into the meat, into the muscle tissue, and takes it longer to cook. Ours cooks in way, way less time. Well, what's that worth? You know, in the kitchen, cooking time is valuable. I mean, you've got labor, you've got energy, you've got infrastructure tie-up time. And so, you know, when you start taking all of those kinds of related things around the actual meal prep procedure from, you know, from human sickness to externalized to satiation to wasted product to cooking time, all of those things, they actually add up to where we tell people, even though our price tag is higher, we actually have the cheapest food in the world because the price that's on the tag is everything. There's no hidden cost. There's nothing out here lurking. There's no bogeyman going to get you from that price. It's the real price, and it's the honest price. And so, so yeah, that's my answer. I don't think we could possibly, you know, sell eggs just straight up price competitive to, you know, to the factory eggs. But there's no comparison to any eggs either.
Yeah.
Ours actually taste good and give you vibrant life.
Well, exactly. I think that's it. I mean, there's obviously a huge nutritional advantage. I think one of the areas where Jamie was highlighting they could save money was exactly what you said. They took these you know, people that worked in the kitchens, and rather than just shoving things in an oven, they taught them how to cook. They used fresh vegetables. They made chicken nuggets from, you know, chicken breasts. I don't know if they were, you know, the best raised chicken, but I mean, again, that's where you would add that extra layer of the budget to really make sure you maximize nutrition in children's health. But you imagine the knock-on effect of the financial side of not having sick Americans anymore. You would save money hand over fist, aside from the ethical issue.
Oh, absolutely. And in that space, I think it's important to realize that right now, today, as you and I talk, I'm sure you've seen the movie, the documentary, Food Inc. And that one, for example, the family that went to Burger King and got that meal for their son and said they couldn't afford vegetables at the supermarket. That fast food meal, you know, with the big soda and the French fries and the burger and all, that fast food meal cost more than 2 whole pounds of our grass-finished ground beef right now. And there's more nutrition in half a pound of our ground beef than that whole fast food meal. And so that's the kind of thing, I think, as Jamie Oliver poked around these edges, you can change your whole, you know, your whole provenance, your whole economic situation if you change your provenance. One of the things that we know right now, for example, is that our pastured GMO-free world-class chicken is, if you get a whole chicken, it's cheaper than a Tyson breast down at Walmart per pound. It's cheaper per pound than a Tyson breast at Walmart. And so if you get a whole chicken from us, you know, you're going to have 3 or 4 meals, eat the whole thing with leftovers. You're going to have broth. You're going to have, you know, all this stuff. You get a boneless, skinless breast down at Walmart from Tyson, and it might be convenient, but you're not actually going to have nutrition. You're not going to actually have value, full value from that boneless, skinless breast. So, you know, whenever somebody starts talking about price, I start looking at, well, what are you currently spending your money on? And pretty quickly, you know, 90% of the people, you can find some very glaring luxuries, unnecessary luxuries, that are eating up the food budget that could much more strategically be spent on, you know, on unprocessed whole foods and eating nose to tail.
Absolutely. Well, it seems like the word false economy applies to so many areas. It applies to, you know, my peers in the tactical professions that are being worked into the ground, you know, and they're saving money, quote unquote, on their staffing, but then they're paying way more when they, you know, retire out or get hurt or all these other, you know, expenses on the back end. But another false economy, which I really want to explore with you, is the effect of factory farming. Now, obviously, any decent human being, just the ethical side would be enough to make you not want to see that and anywhere on planet Earth. But aside from that, you know, growing up in England, we had BSE. We discovered that they were feeding ground up cows to cows in the farms. Tell me about the farming practices and the breeding ground that they create, not only for disease in the animals themselves, but also, you know, maybe a precursor to some of these pandemics that we've seen before.
Well, certainly, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to connect the dots that we are what we eat, we are what we eat. And so if our animals are raised in confinement and fecal particulate, in other words, the air is dusty with their manure, they live in their own manure at all times and breathe it in as well. So it'd be like, you know, you living in your toilet. And they eat there, they sleep there, they do everything there. And they're sedentary, they're confined, they can't exercise, they don't get sunshine, and they don't get fresh air, they don't get exercise, and their diet is completely calorie driven for fast growth, as opposed to completely well-rounded nutrients, so they grow extra fast. If you create that kind of habitat, it is intuitive, even if it's not empirically proven right now, but it certainly is intuitive that if that's what we're eating, that's what we're going to look like. We're going to look like what we eat. And so if the animals are high-stressed, calorie-driven, you know, fat-oriented, non-exercise, then we're going to start looking that same way. In other words, flabby pork makes flabby people. So what's not surprising is that people begin to look like what they eat, and that includes the simplicity on our farms. You know, we don't have diversified farms. We have extremely simplistic ones. And nature is not simplistic. Nature is highly complex. It's very relational. And it's interrelational, synergistic and symbiotic. And our farms are essentially, you know, single species, single plant, single animal. We don't even mix plants and animals. And so that simplicity, and in fact, we even dump chemical fertilizer on the soil as opposed to to leveraging the complexity of the actinomycetes, mycelium, you know, all the soil microbial life that has more beings in a double handful than there are people on the face of the earth. That's how many beings are in a handful of healthy soil. So instead of leveraging that, we simplistically throw on chemical nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus, and then we wonder why our plants have, you know, fungus and disease and need you know, prop ups of fumigants and chemicals and everything else. And so as we develop these crutches, as we develop these pharmaceutical and chemical crutches to take our plants and animals forward in a time of simplistic soil and animal feeding, it's natural that we're going to start crutching. We're going to start seeing the same thing in our population. In fact, in 1950, when he wrote an agricultural testament, Sir Albert Howard, who was kind of the godfather of modern sustainable agriculture, he developed the scientific formula for aerobic composting. Absolute, you know, iconic book, An Agricultural Testament, 1950. Came out in about 1943, so right in the middle of World War II. He had this statement. He said, it is the temptation of every society to turn what nature has spent centuries building into cash. The other thing he said was that when we use artificials, that's what he called chemical fertilizers, artificial manures, he called them artificial manures on the soil. It makes artificial soil, which grows artificial plants, which grows artificial people, who can only be kept alive with artificials.
You nailed it.
If that wasn't prophetically prescient, I don't know what is.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was absolutely spot on, and it's terrifying, and that's the behind the curtain, vision that I've been able to get in the last 15 years, and it's a tragic realization. But you know, I don't want to demonize the medical industry, because they do so many good things, but using pharmaceuticals for chronic disease management is one of the biggest tragedies in human health, where it should be fitness and nutrition reversing and mitigating disease.
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, listen, you know, I'm very thankful that we have some pretty sophisticated medical options in our arsenal today. Absolutely. I'm glad that we have antibiotics. The problem is, though, that, you know, we then created a factory farming system that required antibiotics for the animals to stay alive. A lot of people don't realize that the lion's share of antibiotics in the United States actually don't go through people. They go through animals, and we eat them for dinner. And so, you know, we did a messaging campaign one time, who's been drugging your dinner? You know, we take this something that's really a blessing, that's really a blessing, and we overuse it and abuse it and turn it into a liability, you know, with our own greed and short-sighted view. And so, you know, so here we are. So what we need to be doing is collectively working on and dedicating ourselves to a higher immunological function, and have the hospitals there when we need them, but if they could be limited to accidents and, you know, injury, things like that, it would fundamentally change our economy and our overall cultural wellness.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, going back to the cause as well, just for a moment, so when you look back, you know, there's some certain diseases that have made a huge impact in history. There's the Black Death, there's, you know, cholera, both of which they realized were actually, you know, human waste into, you know, a water supply, or even just in the streets, like old age London. And then you look at the Spanish flu, which very coincidentally happened right after World War One, where, you know, thousands of men lay dying and rotting in trenches in Europe. And then now we look at, COVID, and we're told about the bats in the wet markets. So again, people kind of, you know, wringing their hands and crying to the heavens, like, why is this happening? What element of farming practices and raising animals do you think is contributing to some of these horrendous viruses that we're seeing that are then killing a lot of our people?
Well, whenever you concentrate an inordinate number of animals in a unsanitary place, so we've got concentration, we've got density, we've got mass, you know, scale, size, and we have horrendous unsanitary conditions, and in many cases, proximate, take those three things, you know, concentration, scale, and lack of hygiene, and then mix animals that would never otherwise even be close to each other, otherwise, and certainly not at those kind of concentrations and unsanitary conditions. When you start pushing that envelope, it's naturally going to push you into strange mutations. It's going to push you into new pathogenicities and toxicities that humankind has not seen before. The ability of humans today, with cheap energy, transportation, and you know, distribution capabilities, with, you know, trains and trucks and all that, the our newfound ability to concentrate at scale is unprecedented. You know, when just even a century and a half ago, when it was still all draft power, oxen, horses, mules, draft power, you simply could not concentrate at scale what we were able to do today because you couldn't move enough feedstock in, you couldn't move the manure out, and so you were limited logistically with the ability to transport material. Today, we don't have that limitation. So all around the world, we can overrun the ecological the ecological nest, if you will, a proper hygienic ecological nest. We can overrun that willy-nilly, and in fact we do. And when we do that, we create all sorts of problems. I mean, goodness, North Carolina here in the U.S., North Carolina, if it weren't for a hurricane every 2 years to come in and flush all the pig lagoons in North Carolina, North Carolina today would be covered up in pig manure. But, I call it the biannual flush. And here comes the big hurricane, dumps, 15 inches of rain, and you get all this flooding and flushing, and everything gets, flushed out to sea. You have some massive fish kills. That's part of the collateral damage, and we're good to go for another cycle. And so this is what happens with today's ability to concentrate like we've never been able to do before. Have humans damaged our environment in the past? Absolutely. Throughout history, we've damaged our past, but we've been limited by simple logistics and transportation. You can't destroy but so much acreage when you're walking with a sharp stick behind behind an ox. A person can only touch so much land. But if you're driving a 600 horsepower, 8-wheel drive articulated tractor pulling a 15 bottom plow, you can touch a lot of land in a hurry, and that's the difference. The scale of our ability, to exercise our dominance and control on our womb, on the nest, is simply unprecedented today, and that's one reason why we're seeing a proliferation of this lexicon.
Yeah. I want to get to your new book. I've just got one more area because you kind of really opened that door for a second. We always hear about the rainforests being destroyed and that being related to raising cattle. What's the truth behind that? And again, how can local farming even combat the environmental element?
Well, yes, a lot of it is being destroyed. I'll just say that the problem is in domestic livestock, and certainly cattle are the king of that. In domestic livestock worldwide, we are not mimicking the natural choreography of herbivorous herds throughout the planet. And when you study the way these large herds have worked in the past, and by the way, developed the deepest soils on the planet, they have moved from place to place. They move regarding the rainy season. Predators push them, flies push them, their own bellies push them to new ground. And so there's a constant undulation movement pattern across the prairies, across the Serengeti, across the tundra. That's the way nature moves. But with domestic livestock, we've moved into a sedentary situation where we fence and we leave the animals in one place, which then means they overgraze. There's not a forage rest period, which means the forage isn't ever able to get into its fast its fast kind of juvenile growth curve, which means it's stunted, and then we don't get the solar conversion into biomass that can decompose. So on our farm, we move the cows every day to a new paddock, which means that, you know, each paddock can rest before they come back. Now, the cows might be on a given paddock, oh, you know, 4 to 6 times in a season, but those are only 4 to 6 days in a given spot throughout the season. And so we use high-tech electric fencing to be able to give us a steering wheel, a brake, and an accelerator on that four-legged pruning, that four-legged pruner, to be able to move across the landscape with the animals at the same precision level as a zero-turn mower on a golf course. That's never been done. That's never been possible in human history. So what this does is allow us to mimic. So this is biomimicry of the movement of the animals across the landscape. And all we're trying to do is, on a domestic scale, mimic what we see nature doing on a wild scale. And if everyone did that, the production increase would be unbelievable. In Augusta County, where we live, the average cow days per acre, a cow day is what one cow will eat in a day. So if we took all the food that you eat today and put it on your plate, that'd be one person day of food. So what one cow will eat in a day is one cow day. So in Augusta County, where we live, the average is 80 cow days per acre. So an acre will support 80 cows for one day a year, or eight, or one cow for 80 days a year. The average is 80, and we average 400. So we don't have a resource problem. We don't have a cow problem. We don't have a population problem. We don't have a food problem. What we have is a management problem. And if we could get the management right, then everything else would fall into place.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember, I can't remember if it was in Food Inc. that they featured you, or if it was Forks Over Knives, but, you know, where they're showing that, and your, you know, your cows are followed by the pigs, and the pigs are followed by the chickens, and even the length of the grass that your cows are eating, this very long mature grass versus the very short one that you normally see in pastures, you could just, I mean, it just made perfect sense. Like, you're sending several species through, each one is laying their compost down, and so therefore nourishing the actual land, and when they keep going back, it builds and builds and builds. So just from a complete non-farming common sense point of view, it makes perfect sense.
Sure, that's right. But you see, you don't feel threatened or have to de-learn anything.
That's true. Well, that is a great segue then to the book. So I think hopefully there will be some lessons learned from this. My biggest fear of this whole pandemic is that people go back to doing exactly the same thing they did before, which would be the real tragedy, because even the deaths won't be honored by, you know, some sort of learning. But your new book, Beyond Labels, I think is a great opportunity for people to understand what's in some of the foods that are sitting on the shelves at the moment. So tell me about why you wrote that, and then, you know, how people can find it.
Sure. Well, so I hooked up with this PhD biochemist, Sina McCullough, who had her own brush with death. She was actually planning her funeral as a 32-year-old, and had all sorts of debilitating illnesses and, you know, immunodeficiency. By eating the standard American diet. We call that SAD, standard American diet. And so she, you know, she had her epiphany one day when she said, okay, I can't blame the doctor, I can't blame the food, I can't blame, you know, I've got to do this myself. And so she started using her PhD biochemistry background to research food, and started to change her diet, change her life, and today she's a vibrant, whatever, 38, 39-year-old, I call her an energizer bunny. We did a conference together a couple of years ago, met for the first time. The two of us were the two speakers. I was completely taken and enamored by what she said, And she enjoyed what I said, and she just came up to me at the end and said, let's do a book together. And to my knowledge, a book pairing a farmer with a PhD biochemist has never been done before, and maintaining our own dialogue. So the book, so although we've co-authored it, we've maintained our separate personas throughout the book, so it reads like a play, like a dialogue, like you're sitting in an audience and you're watching two people just talk back and forth. In fact, numerous people who have now reviewed it and read it thought that we actually sat down and had a conversation and then transcribed it for the book. That's not the way we wrote it. We actually did a lot of emails back and forth, and as we kind of got into the rhythm, we were able to play on each other. We learned more about each other and were able to play on it. So the whole idea of the book is a continuum to take you from wherever you are. If you're right now, if you're eating most of your food from the gas station, and you want to go to a better place, this does not talk down, judge, or speak with prejudice against what you're doing. It simply is to take you by the hand, coach you and challenge, yes, and encourage you to move to another level. So the chapters are all titled Practical Bites. There's, I don't know what, 60 practical bites. And they're all written in things that, you know, something that you can do today. And you just add these at your pace. If it takes 2 months, fine. If it takes 3 years, fine. 10 years, fine. That's fine. And you may never get to the end. I mean, Cena and I both realize neither of us actually does all of the whatever, the paradise things that we get to right at the end of the book, but we went ahead and put in kind of our paradise thinking, just so that all of us, including us, could be pushed and encouraged to move to a better place in our lives. And so the book is full of how to build immune system, how to save time in the kitchen, how to source, how to find, how to cut through the whole thing beyond labels. You know, if you're dependent on labels for food buying, you're probably pretty disconnected from your food. And so we punch through some of the clever speak and the way the FDA allows things to be labeled, like generally accepted as safe, GRAS. That's a big sleeping giant in the labeling industry. And we pull that aside and lead you non-prejudicially through a continuum to a place of understanding, so you can make better decisions on your own food providence. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get you to a better place, a better decision-making place, so that you can feel confident and comfortable with your own decisions, and you're not just dependent on phraseology and clever labels that almost never speak honestly about what's actually contained.
Yeah, no, and I think that's so important, and you hit on a very good point about, you know, just starting today. I think, you know, people see some people at the moment, you know, wearing a mask in their own car, and people kind of like ridicule them, but people got to understand the environment they're in. If you get your information, for example, from Fox News and CNN, you're going to have a very skewed perspective. I was raised with now realizing all the wrong nutritional advice, all the wrong, you know, weight training advice too. You know, everything was around the bodybuilding machines, and I became a fireman. That didn't serve me well either. But forgiving yourself where you are today, saying, all right, you got me, you know, advertising people or, you know, whatever industry kind of led you that way. But today is when you start educating. And the more education you have, the more power you're going to realize you have over your own health, over, you know, everything around you. And then if that happens in all the households down the street and all the towns in the county and then exponentially to the country, we're literally going to change the way, you know, our country's health looks within 10 years.
Yes, yes. And in true kind of, you know, libertarian fashion, this book does not ask for additional government oversight. It doesn't ask for subsidies. It doesn't ask for agencies, tax incentives, or anything else. It's all about us individually. Here's what we can do right now, today, and walk steadily and, you know, and make progress into a different health future for ourselves. That's what we're after. We're after a time when you wake up in the morning and you're not thinking about health issues because you're vibrant, you're full of life, and you wake up in the morning ready to get at it, and you're not dwelling on your own whatever health limitations. That's a place of optimum health.
Absolutely. And I agree with you 100%. I mean, the environment should be there for people to thrive, but the way we start that, clearly having seen, you know, the last several decades, whether it's our food, whether it's drug policy, whatever it is, you know, when you look back and realize that system's failed, then you have to be part of the problem. I mean, excuse me, part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Yes.
All right. Well, then some closing questions I didn't get to ask you last time because I kind of added them later on in the podcast. We talked about your book. Obviously, you've got several others as well, and we're going to get to where they can find that in a moment. Are there any books that other people have written that you love to recommend? It can be related to what we've discussed or something completely different.
Well, there's a new one just out that I'm pushing when I have a chance called Sacred Cow. It's just being launched literally this week. By Rob Wolf, the founder of Paleo, and it's a co-authored book also. Diana Rogers, who's a dietitian, podcaster of the podcast Sustainable Dish, and Sacred Cow, and they take on the four basic arguments against, you know, eating meat, especially beef, and so it's a great companion. Now, this is the kind of book that I use as a companion and get, you know, hardcore information out of, you know, nutrient analysis and things to, you know, to help people eat a more, well, to help people realize that, veganism is not the solution to health issues. I mean, we have many customers. We have thousands of customers, and we deal routinely with folks who went through the vegan fad and their health suffered and deteriorated. There are a few people, very few, who actually thrive on an almost, you know, meatless diet, but they're not very many. Most people over time will deteriorate in their health, and so Sacred Cow has been a great friend here. I'm glad they've written it.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna have to reach out to a mutual friend of Rob's because we've been trying to get him on for a little while. But if he's got a new book, that's a good time. He actually was an EMT back in the day as well, so. It's interesting, just touching on the vegan thing for a moment. I went plant-based for about 6 months. I really noticed some great benefits, but then towards that, you know, I think what they call the vegan honeymoon, you know, did notice a kind of decline in my what seemed like energy. So kind of transitioned to putting some meat on, but I've had, James Wilkes that did the Game Changers on. I've had, you know, the whole gamut of dietary philosophers, if you like. And to me, the middle ground is the clean vegetables and then, you know, and or the clean meat. So it's funny with some conversations, these two sides, like, you know, want to murder each other. But, you know, the lesson learned is, like you said, there are people that do thrive on veganism and good for them. And there are seemingly people that thrive on carnivore diet, which I find very intriguing as well. But the majority of us with clean, holistically raised meat and clean vegetables and fruit are gonna thrive. And I think that's the conversation that gets missed on the two extremes slinging arrows at each other.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And part of the, you know, part of the Beyond Labels book that Tina and I wrote were ways to, you know, listen to your body, to listen. I mean, we don't trust ourselves anymore. We've been so expertized in our culture, you know, and kind of almost what's the word? You can't fix your refrigerator, you can't fix your television, you can't fix your car, and we've kind of been unmoored from our ability to take care of ourselves. And so you know, so you ask the expert, And, you know, investing is too hard, so you have an investment advisor. And so we assume that I can't know anything. You know, what do I know? I'm not a doctor. I'm not a nutritionist. I'm not a dietitian. And the fact is that, we live in our skin. You know, we live with ourselves. We see what our poop looks like. We feel what the urine looks like. You know, we actually live in this. And so, so making our daily observations, we know the aches and the pains and whether we have a bloated feeling or whether whether we feel bouncy or lethargic, and so experiment. You know, that's the whole point, is be willing to step out there and experiment some, but don't join a cult, don't jump off on a fad. Do some experiments, keep some mental notes, and you'll gradually find. You're exactly right. Some people thrive on a meatless thing, not very many, and you're right. I'm completely intrigued by the whole, you know, carnivore thing. You know, as a livestock farmer, that really intrigues me. But and then some people, you know, they get completely off of grains. But then again, you go to, you know, a place that does old heritage Egyptian type grains and heavy breads in those areas, and it's a whole different context and a different situation than, for example, American short stem grains. That's another discussion. But anyway, listen to yourself wherever you are. Listen to yourself, and you'll be surprised what you might learn.
I couldn't agree more. All right. Well, then another question: is there a movie or documentary that you love?
Movie or documentary? You know, I don't watch. I don't watch very many documentaries. I guess one of the, you know, one of my favorites is still Fresh, and it came out the same year that Food Inc. came out. But Fresh is as positive as Food Inc. is shockingly negative. And I mean, I don't like Food Inc. It was a shocker, but the documentary Fresh had a much more positive message, and you left that one saying, yes, you know, yes, we can do this. It was very empowering and encouraging. Just one word, Fresh, and it's a good one.
Brilliant. And I saw on the website, I don't know how I missed this, but Polyface has a documentary. Is that right?
We didn't do it. It was done by a couple from Australia. Yes, it's called Polyfaces, and it was done by an Australian couple, and yes, that's if you want to see more, you know, of the farm here and what we do in our life, that's a good one.
Brilliant. All right. Is the next question, is there a person that you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, medical community, and military of the world?
First responder community. I'm just blank right now. I have to pass on that. That was kind of a
no problem. It was a new one.
I wasn't quite prepared for that one.
I apologize. Yeah. Well, actually, thinking about it, your co-author of Carbon, Beyond Labels might actually be a good guess as well. Someone who literally dragged themselves out.
Yeah. Why am I silly on that? Yes, absolutely. She would be fantastic. Sina McCullough does. She's a very vibrant interview. And she would be able to speak to that extremely well, yes.
Brilliant. All right, so then one more question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you online. What do you do to decompress?
Decompress? My recreation is reading, just a good book, whether it's fiction or not. I don't read a lot of fiction, mainly nonfiction, but to decompress, just, you know, reading something, just enjoying what somebody else's thoughts, instead of having to answer questions and make up my own, is a way I decompress.
Brilliant. Well, actually, I just 2 days ago, I sent a book I've just written, my very first book, to an editor, and I actually quote you in there. You think food is expensive? Have you priced cancer lately? I think that was the quote I used. but I want to send you a copy of that, so I will.
Great, thank you. When it's finally out. Yes, I look forward to that. Yes, I read. I read voraciously.
Fantastic. Well, let's hope this will probably be a little different than what you've read. It's kind of like behind the curtain of what we see, so a different perspective. All right, so then the very last question, if people want to reach out to you, if they want to buy the books, if they want to visit the farm and actually buy some of your food, how do they find you online?
So the website is Polyface Farms, P-O-L-Y-F-A-C-E. In fact, if you Google it, once you get to about P-O-L-Y, the rest of it will pop up. Polyface Farms, and we have a very active website, gift shop. You can buy food. You can buy T-shirts that say things like "Everything I want to do is illegal," and you can see where I'm, you know, where I am speaking. Get linked up to news articles, things like that. But and see pictures of the farm, all those kind of things. So yeah, the website is polyfacefarms.com. And love to have you check it out. And there's a lot of material information there. And we do ship nationwide. So anybody that wants to try something, just order it right there online, and we ship every week. And be glad to serve you.
Excellent. Well, again, Joel, I want to say thank you so much. 4 years ago, I said I'm going to come up and visit soon. I still haven't yet and haven't made it up to the Northeast at all, but it was actually my plan this summer before this craziness happened. But hopefully I'll maybe even get to give you the book face to face. But, I appreciate you taking the time once again, and your perspective is invaluable anytime, but especially now. So I hope people have gleaned, you know, the preventative element of this whole situation we've been through.
Yes. Thank you very much for having me on. I look forward to the next time, and do please come and visit when you can. Love to have you.